Thanks for listening to the Not a Diving podcast. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our private Discord server, sign up at patreon.com/scubaofficial.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is Not a Diving Podcast with Scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving Podcast. Right, I'm just taking some time off from my busy schedule of making burial edits to bring you this podcast. I'm actually not, that's a complete lie. I'm in India, although actually I'm recording this before going to India. But when this goes out, when you hear this, I will be in India. Unfortunately, my shows in India have been cancelled, which is annoying. In fact, I had two shows cancelled. One show got cancelled and then the replacement show also got cancelled. So I'm basically sunning myself for a week before going to Japan, where I play at Vent in Tokyo on Friday the 29th of March. And then on Saturday the 30th of March, I play at Potent in Shanghai, my first time ever in Shanghai. I've played in Beijing before, but never in Shanghai. So I'm really looking forward to that. It's going to be fun. And I should have a decent suntan by the time those gigs roll around, but that's all good. That's all good. I'm going to enjoy myself nonetheless. So yeah, that's what happens, I guess, occupational hazard. On the show today, we are talking to Nathan Mackay about many things, but probably most importantly, film scores, and specifically electronic musicians making a career in film music and TV, because that's exactly what he's done. He's really built up a really impressive CV of work that he's done in that area over the past few years, starting off with the Industry series on Netflix. He's done a whole bunch of other stuff since then. So he really knows what he's talking about in this area. And I know lots of you who listen to this show are interested in doing this stuff and are interested, generally speaking, in film music, TV. It's actually TV more than film, isn't it? Because, I mean, film is a little bit of an afterthought these days in terms of the kind of cutting edge visual stuff that goes on. Is that fair? Is that fair? Maybe. I don't know. We are living through a golden age of TV, I think. I guess if you're going to make a career doing that kind of thing, you're going to be doing a lot of TV in all likelihood. But yeah, Nathan's done both. So great to have him on the show. He's also, of course, a successful dance producer and DJ. Many of you will know his name from doing that stuff, of course, as well. And, you know, he's just been around the scene. So there's lots of stories, scene stories in this week's episode, which are always fun to hear too, aren't they? So yeah, great to have Nathan on. Right, just before we get into that, a reminder that you can get rid of the ads by signing up on Patreon, patreon.com/scubaofficial. There's two tiers over there, both of which are extremely cheap. The more expensive one gets you all the music that we release on Hot Flash Recording. So that's pretty good, isn't it? Two, patreon.com/scubaofficial. You can also use the links over at scubaofficial.io/support to support us in other ways, including via an Ethereum wallet. Yes, an Ethereum wallet. If you don't want to support financially, that's also cool. Completely understand. The best thing you can do to support the show in that case is follow the show on whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on and leave us a review. Yeah, reviews are important again in terms of hitting the algorithm. So yeah, leave a gushing review with a 5-star rating and I'll be grateful, and I'll also enjoy reading them. So, yeah. Okay, the only other thing is to remind you that we have a Discord server, hotflushrecordings.com/discord gets you through. We'd love to have you in there to talk about whatever you want to talk about. Okay, that's enough of this. Without further delay, here is Nathan Mackay. Nathan Mackay, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm great. Thanks for having me. I've been a pretty consistent listener, actually.
Ah, good, good. Well, yeah, hopefully we'll do justice to previous episodes. We were supposed to do this a few weeks ago, of course, but I was laid up with, my sciatic nerve was being pressed.
Yeah, how's the leg doing?
It's significantly better, yeah, thank you. But you were saying, actually, when we were conversing on email, that you have some insight into this, correct?
Yeah, well, you know, nothing crazy, but just, you know, for many years I was a personal trainer here for DJs, mostly DJs, and quite a few were hitting their 40s, I suppose, and getting sciatica and, yeah, doing a lot of strengthening, a lot of, like, stretching, trying to figure out the best ways to handle it, I guess you could say.
Right, so what's the, the average kind of physical condition of a DJ in your experience?
Oh, I mean, they come in all shapes and sizes, but I'd say, you know, I've had a few, I haven't personal trained anyone for about 6 or 7 years now, but it was my main sort of thing besides DJing when I first moved here for like 3 years. And I had a few big success stories where I had one pretty famous notable DJ producer lose about 10 kilos over the course of 7 to 8 months. And
nice.
Had another one who was in a car accident, and we started doing a lot of heavy weight training, and their hips just started to feel much stronger, more aligned. So yeah, but then I had a few where, you know, no matter what I tried to do, I couldn't compete with the allure of the weekend party, and eventually I would just sort of give up.
Right, okay.
But, you know, God bless him for trying.
Sure, yeah, I mean, that probably makes sense, right, I guess. So, okay, how long have you lived in Berlin for then?
I've been in Denmark for the last 2 years or so. So including that, I've been in Europe for about 9 years this spring.
Right. So
too long, but I'm still here.
Yeah. Okay. Do you live in Copenhagen now? Is it Copenhagen?
No, no, I'm back in Berlin. I live actually I'm in Neukölln, belly of the beast.
How is Berlin these days? I always ask this question of people because, you know, I lived there for a long time, but it's been a very long time since I lived there now. And it does seem to, every time I come and visit, it seems like almost a different place, right? So what's it like now?
Yeah. You know, actually, that's one of the things I've enjoyed about your podcast when you have people on who've lived here, especially, I forget his name. You had a Canadian guy who was big in the minimal scene. It's escaping me, but anyway, you can look it up. But the Deadbeat one was also interesting. So I'm always fascinated by hearing stories about Berlin in the early 2000s. And, you know, it's funny, I meet people who've moved here in the last couple of years, and I now sound like that guy who's like, oh, you've missed it. You know, it's over, blah, blah, blah. Because when I moved here, I could get a room here for about 400 euros a month. And I had this gigantic room in Wedding, which is in the northwest of the city. I don't think you could get that anymore. Anyway, to answer your question, it's at once just as dirty and grimy as it was since I've moved here. Just everything's about 3 times as expensive. And at the same time, somehow also grimier, if that makes sense. It okay. It seems like the city's, like the bureaucracy and the municipality of the city's kind of running out of money or something, because you do notice trains are now running at 10-minute intervals on the weekends, and
right,
there's often no train service to the airport. So I feel for my DJ friends who still have to do that. But, you know, I'm still here. Still like it. I mean, I can still have a pretty nice life here for an affordable price, and life here moves pretty slow for the most part.
Sure, okay.
Maybe too slow.
Yeah, I think you were talking about Jeremy P. Caulfield. Was that him?
Yes, that was it. Sorry, yes.
Yeah, okay. So, obviously you do a lot of scoring work now, but also you release your own music
in
a significant quantity. So, judging from what you just said, you don't really see yourself as a DJ. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I did quite a bit of touring this past fall for the first time really since the pandemic. But I've sort of, it's fallen to the side a little bit for a few reasons. One, as you said, my life is pretty much just scoring TV and film now. And I've tried to manage the two at the same time, especially this past fall, but it's pretty hard when, you know, you get home on a Sunday evening after playing 2 gigs and then suddenly someone from the show you're working on says, we need this by tomorrow. And you know, the last thing you want to do is stay up till 2 a.m. tweaking some orchestral piece or something, you know?
Right.
And then on top of that, just living in Denmark the last couple of years, they have very intense immigration laws. And long story short, while you wait for your visa there, you're not allowed to leave the country. So I essentially just had 9 months sitting around waiting. So I canceled all my DJing and I'm slowly getting back into it now. And then the final reason, just I had COVID last year and it's led to this crazy tinnitus where
really?
Now been pretty debilitating. So I slowly getting back to like being able to hear things at a normal volume, but playing it very cautious.
Shit, that sounds bad. Tell me more about that. I think I vaguely heard about that being a side effect that some people get, but how common is it?
Yeah, it was crazy. It was around like December 5th. I started to feel a little off, you know, so I got home test and it said I had COVID, you know, nothing crazy. It was like a flu sort of situation. And then this ringing started in my right ear and it just grew and grew. And then eventually it became this like tritone, like ambulance level ringing. I didn't sleep for a few days. I saw 3 different ear doctors and they all said, we're seeing more and more of this. This is becoming a very common thing we're seeing with COVID. And one actually said he had it for 6 months himself. Anyway, yeah, the first 3 weeks were terrible. They put me on a cortisol steroid, which they said is the only really weapon they have. And you have to take it in the first couple weeks of this happening or else it doesn't do anything. And even then they said it's like a 40% chance it'll work. The steroid was brutal, but it worked. And now it's just kind of like a light ringing, which I can live with, but still sucks.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I still check, like I still dig for records all the time, just out of habit. I'm still listening. I still like tapped into the culture more or less, but there's still more and more people I don't recognize on lineups. So I guess I'm also a little more tapped out than I'd like to be.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So your work in film and TV, is that something that you consciously, was that a kind of career move that you consciously made, or was it something which is a common way into this, is that you get hired to do one and then it's kind of happy coincidence and it snowballs? Like how much of a kind of plotted career path was this for you?
It was a mixture of both. It was always my goal and my dream to do this. Like when I moved to Berlin to be a DJ, it was always in the back of my head that like I want to put out albums that lead me to get scouted for some HBO series. And it was my goal. I had it on a piece of paper. I write things down a lot. It was my goal to have this happen by about the time I was 35. And then I guess just through some lucky break, it happened when I was 30.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did quite a few indie Canadian films that nobody's ever seen probably. I don't even know how to find them, but I did those in my 20s just to sort of I would take any offers I could for like no money just to get the experience. And so that when the day does come, when Netflix or HBO or someone of a higher profile comes along, I had something to show that I've done this before. And that's kind of exactly what happened. In this case, to get specific, like my sort of breakout scoring role is this HBO series called Industry.
Yeah.
And the two writers of that show were introduced to an album I put out in 2019 called Blue Spring, and they really liked it and they approached me and I had this big meeting in London and they asked, yeah, have you ever done this before? I said, actually I have. And I had this whole reel ready to go. And then I think
that's handy. That is very handy.
I think they also just wanted to meet me and make sure I wasn't like, you know, some insane DJ guy who would like, you know, derail the entire thing by partying. But then pretty quickly we realized that if, you know, they probably party more than I do. So yeah, that's pretty much, it's like kind of like this serendipitous thing that happened. And then it happened that started right as COVID hit. So it was like this perfect sort of transition to a new career, at least for me.
In the previous jobs that you'd done, like the indie movies that you mentioned, was that a case of working to something with a very high degree of creative control? I mean, did you just make music for them, or how much to-ing and fro-ing was there with the filmmakers?
Well, the first thing I learned very quickly was no matter what the budget is, if you're working on someone's project and they're passionate about it, obviously they're going to have opinions, which is great because you want to work with someone like that. But yeah, even on these low budget indie Canadian things, yeah, they had many opinions. I learned the realities that, you know, 60% of what you make kind of gets rejected or you have to change it.
Sure.
I went into all of this stuff thinking that like you read interviews with like Trent Reznor, who's like, yeah, you know, we sent David Finch like an hour of music and then he just put it in the movie. And it's not like that.
Yeah, right.
It might work like that if you're like Trent Reznor and you have David Fincher like begging you to do a score, maybe. But even then, I'm sure there was tons of rewriting and editing. And I'm sure if Trent didn't have to do it, David had someone else doing it, you know?
Right.
So yeah, even on those early ones, I had to learn what a cue sheet is. I had to learn what a spotting session is, how to just navigate keeping track of your drafts, which is huge. Like, you have to keep track of every little thing because it could be, you know, suddenly the director or the producer wakes up in 3 months and they say, hey, can you send that thing you did on October 4th, version 3? And you have to find it very quickly. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it was, you know, obviously a smaller workload than the stuff I'm doing now and much lower stakes, but similar sort of idea.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I have done one of these, so I kind of, I recognize the process that you're describing there. What was striking to, well, okay. So what I found really difficult actually was, I suppose it's the kind of eternal kind of creative differences that you inevitably have with other people that you're working on the project, on a project with. I did a movie, like an independent movie a couple of years ago.
Oh yeah. Which one?
It's called Blow Up My Life. It came out streaming just a few months ago. And actually, it was way out of my comfort zone because actually, it was a comedy.
Oh, that's the hardest music to write.
Yeah, right. Writing music for a comedy is tough. But I found that I really had some quite sharp divergences with the director on the musical tone for certain scenes. And that, to me, was really tough to get through. So I imagine you must have had similar experiences, right, along the way.
Yeah, but I think I learned very fast to play the politics of the game, if you will. So I more or less, even if I don't agree with something, I more or less keep my mouth shut and just try to align what I'm doing with their vision. But of course, you always sometimes can think like, not sure that's the road I would have gone. But
I think that seems to me like a very useful piece of experience that you probably quite quickly learn. But like I said, like, this is sort of, the project that I'm describing was literally the first time I've done anything like that. And that was the major hurdle for me, I have to say.
I think, you know, when we do our own music, you know, you're a very accomplished album making musician and I've done a couple. You're allowed to sort of go your own flow. Maybe, yeah, you'll be working with an A&R of a label, but they're going to be more hands-off than like a director who's hired you to help with their vision. You know what I mean? And I think that's one of the funniest things that's happened with all this is I've had a lot of DJ people in our scene or whatever, reach out since I started doing this professionally and consistently asking what it's like, how do you get into it? I want to do this. Explain it to me. When I explain that, like when I send like an average day of notes that I get sent to them, they're just like, well, that looks terrible. I'm like, well, it's not terrible, but it's like, you get used to it. You get used to it. And you have to remember that one of the most interesting things that's happened to me. So I did a film last year was this Sydney Sweeney movie called Reality.
Yep.
That's now on, I don't know where it is in the UK, but in the United States, you can watch it on HBO. And it premiered at the Berlin Film Festival. And it was my first time having anything I've worked on at a big festival. So I went and I'm at the table with like 50 people who've all worked on this film. And I've only ever spoken to two of them.
Right.
And then you get to meeting people and everyone's like, oh, I'm the third DP. Or I don't even know what that means. I'm the fourth editor. And you get to realize that everyone's just working in synergy on this thing together. And I, you know, this is a smaller movie. I can't even imagine what it's like working on a giant movie. And you're a small piece of the puzzle. You're an important piece of the puzzle, but you are just a piece of the puzzle that the director is somehow navigating through, collecting everyone's ideas and work together to make this final piece of art or whatever. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was interesting. That was super interesting to meet all these people. Somebody who's in charge of the Foley. I do the music by myself. On your average Netflix show or whatever I'm working on, there's like six people doing Foley alone, which is crazy.
Right.
And I've been in these meetings where you're hanging out with the director in some big room and they're talking to the Foley people and I'm not supposed to be there, but I'm just hanging out and they're just sampling key sounds or like jangling key sounds, like, no, I don't like that key sound, that's a good key sound. And it's like, it, the level of detail is crazy. And you know, if I was a Foley person, I might be like, oh, I don't like that footstep sound, but if you like it, sure, we'll use it, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. It sounds like, I mean, I actually I seriously considered sort of retraining in that exact stuff, like the sound, like that sort of sound design for,
oh, it's fascinating,
film and TV.
I
think it is, but I think I, well, having sort of dug into it quite deeply and thought about it quite seriously, I realized that it requires a level of kind of anally retentive attention to detail that I just don't really possess. Do you know what I mean? And actually what I find fun about music is just kind of making tunes. Do you know what I mean? Which is a very different mindset.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's one of the freeing things. Like, you know, sure, you don't have full control of what you're making in the sense of they can approve and say yes to this, no to that, and lead you in a way that you might not agree with. But I also love the limitations of it where they say, all right, go make this 4-minute thing. It has to be sad at this point, happy at this point. And we want to have a cello, an electric guitar, and I don't know, some other thing. And you just have to figure that out. And it's like a puzzle. You're given the pieces. You have to put it together. I love that.
Okay. So, I mean, I know there's going to be a lot of people who are curious as to actually the kind of mechanics, the nuts and bolts of how this works. So taking the industry, well, season one of industry as an example, can you talk us through the process? I mean, I realize that's kind of a big non-specific question or non-specific request, but can you just kind of like walk us through what it's like to do this kind of piece of work?
So up front, you know, when I got hired for industry, as I said, it was my first big time, like HBO, whatever. And I had an idea of how things work, but I'd never worked on anything like this. And the other thing you have to realize too, is every production has its own sort of workflow. So whatever I say I'll talk about industries, but other things I've worked on have very different ways of working, but they generally are similar. So yeah, so let's say you get hired for your first show, you have your first big meeting, and the main meeting you have when you work on something is called a spotting session. And I'm sure you did this on what you worked on. So you get called in, I'm sure before pandemic it was in person, but nowadays it's just Zoom, or they use this other thing called Evercast, same thing. And yeah, so you're on this meeting with everyone involved, the directors, producers, maybe a music supervisor, whoever's doing it. And you make, if you're smart, you make a spreadsheet, a big joint spreadsheet called a cue sheet. And it has all the information about the music in the episode. You have to name and number each scene, say when it's in, when it's out, who did the music for it. In my case, it's typically me. And the point of that is just so everyone can keep track of what's going on as you're scoring and keeping progress of stuff. But also you have to submit it to the powers that be in collection agencies so that if there are opportunities to make royalties from TV or whatever you're working on, you'll get the credit you deserve and it's properly like registered with collection agencies. So next part of so you make this spreadsheet and you fill it in as you go and you essentially all watch the episode together. And it takes like 3 hours to watch a 45-minute episode because you're constantly stopping. It's like, okay, this seems to be a place where there could be music. What do we all think? And we have a big discussion. And then I'm frantically writing down notes. Then you have like the notes of like 15 different, not 15, like six or seven different people. And you have to sort of take the culmination of everything that you've heard over the last hour or 3 hours. And then you just get going and then you just get going and you start sending draft after draft after draft. And then they say, yes, no, 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 maybe. And you have to reduce, change, and then you do the next drafts. And then as you're doing that, you have to make folders to keep track of what you're making, the date, the version. And that's pretty much how you get going. Now, when it gets real crazy though, and then the other thing I should say is, yeah, every company you work for has a different file sharing service. So right. For instance, HBO has its own special Warner Brothers fancy schmancy super speedy Dropbox, whereas Netflix used a different one and Paramount used just your average Dropbox, which was funny to me.
Right.
But it's all different. But then the other thing as you're going is just you have to keep in mind that you have very limited time for everything. So for the first episode, maybe you get like a month, and then every episode after that, you get like 2 or 3 weeks, maybe even a week. So as you're going, if you're doing an 8-part series, which I'm doing right now, we're in the final little bit here. By the end of it, you know, you're finishing episode 6, you're halfway through episode 7 and you're starting episode 8, and it gets real messy real fast. And that's why having these cue sheets and draft folders and just labeling everything as meticulously as you can is so helpful, because you can get lost in the sauce real fast. Sorry, that was a long answer to your question. That's pretty much how you get going.
No, not at all. I mean, that sounds, doing multiple episodes really sounds like a whole extra layer of challenge going on there. So, for a 45-minute TV episode, what do you end up with, generally speaking, in terms of like how many minutes of audio do you generally speaking have to?
Oh, well, it varies. And on industry, and I also just finished a show for Paramount. On both of those series, I have what's called a music editor. Mm. And their job is essentially, well, they have a few jobs, but in relation to me, their main job with me is that, you know, on industry, HBO made a very conscious note of, we've now done 3 seasons of industry, and it's been like this the whole time, where they were like, wow, we're really enjoying the music. It'd be great if you could have it at all times, pretty much. So that's an impossible, not at all times, but like quite a lot, if you know what I mean. So that's quite an impossible task for me. So for instance, in season one, what we decided to do was we had a meeting and we were like, look, no one could make this much music. So I went and wrote like 15 1.5 minute pieces of music. Like some were loops, some were just sort of meandering 1.5 minute things that you could play around with. Mm-hmm. And I sent the stems of all those to my music editor, this guy, Dan Elms, who's a real veteran of the industry. And he's been super helpful for me learning how this all works. He usually works with this guy, Max Richter, who's quite an accomplished composer. And then his job is just to take those stems and use them to make new pieces of music that can fit in the gaps of the scenes I don't have time to do, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So for me personally, on any given episode, I'm probably putting together on average 30 to 35 minutes of original music.
Right. Okay.
Maybe even 40. But again, a lot of it is also starts to repeat itself. But you just, the real thing that, and I think most people have assistance for this. I don't, because I'd rather just do it myself for now, is that you have to like reformat it for every scene. So say you have, I don't know, Paul is sad on the podcast theme, you know, like I have to write a theme that makes you sad on the podcast. And then maybe in episode 3, you're sadder than the last time you were sad. So I have to make that fit, make it a little sadder. Maybe the scene's a minute longer than the other scene. So I have to find a way to extend it for a minute while still keeping it interesting and like developing and evolving. So yes, things like this. So, but yeah, I'd say on average 35, maybe 40 minutes per episode. But then I'm working on the final episode of season 3 for industry right now, and it's like 20 minutes.
Right.
Because it's just a lighter, it has a lot of rehashing of stuff I've already done, so I haven't had to write very much new stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, I've listened to the industry score. It's great. I mean, it's it's entirely electronic, right? That one.
There is orchestral in it, but yeah, the first season's super electronic. The second season has quite a lot more orchestral. This season's pretty hybrid, I'd say.
Okay, I mean, my question was going to be, you know, I can imagine making electronic stuff in this volume and, you know, I can imagine a workflow where that would be doable. I mean, presumably involving, you know, orchestras and that sort of thing complicates the process quite significantly, right?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't fully worked with like a full orchestra yet, just because it's this funny thing where, so the show I just finished for Paramount Plus, it's called Sexy Beast. It's based on the, I think it's 2000, Jonathan Glazer film.
The Ray Winston movie.
You know, the classic film. Yeah. So they did like a prequel series and, you know, we had a very limited amount of time. And one of the notes from one of the executives was like, I was working with string emulation, like this company Spitfire Audio and Native Instruments. They make great digital string emulation libraries.
Yep.
And then they're like, these sound great, but you know, we need to get it with a full orchestra. I was like, sure, no problem. What's the budget and how long do we have? And they'll be like, oh, we need it by, you know, next week. And that's just not going to happen. So you're constantly given tasks like this where you're like, okay, well, they're like, here's the budget, just get it done by next week. And so I just started on that show. What I would do is I would just record myself playing string instruments in layers to try and emulate a orchestra, and then put that on top of string libraries. And then you get this sort of hybrid sound of real separately recorded strings that I'm doing on top of an orchestra. And I got this idea because I listened to quite a lot of interviews with composers. And during the pandemic, obviously, nobody was recording full COVID-infested, disgusting orchestras. So they were doing it like person by person through Zoom, which is interesting. And it seems to have worked.
Wow. That's incredible. It really is.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I did, but by myself. So
yeah, okay.
It's time consuming, but you get these Ableton files that have like, you know, God, like 200 channels because you're constantly consolidating, and but you do it, and then at the end result, the directors are happy and everyone's happy. So, but then on that show, another interesting thing like this was like, you know, that in that show takes place in Spain, like in the original film, and so they said, we want flamenco guitar. Can you play flamenco guitar? I was like, absolutely not. But I'm sure I could find somebody who can. So I found a Danish guy named Peter who fucking shreds on flamenco guitar. And yeah, got him in the studio and he laid down some amazing stuff and it's all over the show.
Nice.
But again, it was like, we need this by next week. So I had like 3 days to frantically find someone who knew how to play flamenco guitar in Denmark. I'm sure I could have like found someone elsewhere, but I wanted to do it in person. Yeah, and it worked out. So it's just like you have all these little shortcuts and these little problems to solve all the time. And like with this season of Industry, for instance, we've had a lot more strings than in the previous ones. And it's been the same thing where I'm just trying to problem solve and make things happen. And I listen to other interviews with composers and this seems to be just the way it goes. You really just have to figure it out.
It's funny because as you said, there's so many people that work on a production like this, but actually the person making the music... It's a fairly solitary pursuit, right? And obviously the music is such an important part of any kind of, you know, any kind of visual, you know, TV, movie, whatever. Like it's absolutely crucial. And it does seem like it's a kind of unique position to be in on the production team, right?
Oh, for sure. And to go back to that big dinner I mentioned earlier with the Sydney Sweeney movie, it became very evident to me very quickly that everyone at that table had met each other and knew each other in some capacity.
Right.
And then when they'd ask, oh, who are you? I was like, oh, I'm Nathan. Oh, you're the music guy. And I realized like you kind of are an island unto yourself. You're off doing your own thing where everyone else is either at set all working together to film the actual thing or, you know, the Foley people have to talk to the effects people and blah, blah, blah. But the music person kind of is just talking to the director and maybe some producers. Mm. So it's kind of a funny thing. But I kind of like that. It's like this own little world in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, let's just get technical for a moment. You mentioned playing string instruments, and actually there's a bunch of photos. I think it's in the Mix Mag piece of you playing a violin in your studio, which I'm presuming is...
Yeah, viola. Yeah, I've played viola for many years.
Right, okay. So tell me what's in that studio. It looks like you've got a fucking great desk in there.
Well, okay, so that studio was in Denmark, and now I'm back in a home studio in Neukölln. But yeah, to go back to the studio... When you say desk, do you mean like a mixing desk?
Yeah, I meant this, yeah, soundboard, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So that wasn't in my... So that studio, my old studio in Denmark was in this building in this area of Copenhagen called Refshaleen, which is kind of this old industrial area, and it has the biggest music studio building in Denmark, and I was lucky enough to have a studio there for about a year.
Nice.
So in my studio there, it wasn't much different to my setup here. I have like a couple mics, my big computer, a second screen... fancy chair for my posture, and you know,
yeah,
a piano and a viola and a keyboard. However, I made friends with a guy who was above me named Michael, and that mixing board was in his studio, and that's where we mixed my album that came out last summer. And he has like every piece of gear you could think of, pretty much. I couldn't even tell you what that desk was. I am one of the least literate people when it comes to gear you'll ever talk to. I don't know anything.
Okay.
So sorry to not get technical, but
absolutely
why, you know, I used to teach a lot here in Berlin, like volunteer teaching at this school that teaches Ableton and just electronic music to people here. And I think I was a popular teacher just because I was sort of like an everyday schlub, if you will, in the studio, because right, it's really, if you saw my setup, it's incredibly bare bones.
Can you describe it?
I just did. It's a computer, an ergonomic chair. I've got a standing desk.
Yeah, that's
okay. Literally it. I have a UAD sound interface or whatever that I've used for like 12 years. It's so old that it has the original Thunderbolt cable in it. I should really just buy a new one.
Right. Okay. Yeah,
however, what I lack in physical digital or analog gear, I am very versed in digital sound libraries. I probably have one of the biggest sound library collections of anyone in Berlin, I would be confident to say.
Nice.
Just like Kontakt, all these other little manufacturers you never heard of, Spitfire Audio, you know, that stuff. I got pretty hard with all that stuff.
Yeah, the Spitfire stuff is great, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Amazing. But then there's all these tiny some of them aren't tiny, but there's so many different manufacturers. And then once you start getting into this stuff, you realize how sophisticated it can get and how specialized. You know, like I have one library I use called Sunset Strings by a company called Real Tone. Mm-hmm. They have like 5 products they've made, one of which is a great banjo emulator for all you country music fans out there. Anyway.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
They do a fantastic, this one string library, it just has a fantastic soltasto articulation, which is when you sort of brush the bow along a string very lightly and it has like a scraping sound.
Yeah.
And I spent 200 euros buying it just for that, you know?
Nice. Money well spent.
And then I have another one called Bunker Strings just for its pizzicato articulation. And this stuff's expensive, but it sounds great. And it can be the difference between getting a piece of music over the line with the production.
Okay. So you mentioned a couple of albums that you've released. Obviously, there was one last year, On Lucky Me. And I think the previous one was On Lucky Me 2, wasn't it?
They've all been On Lucky Me.
I believe. Right. Yeah. Okay. So how do you go between the two things? I mean, like, to what extent is it a challenge, or is it just quite nice to be able to go between making music just for yourself, or you know, making solo records, so to speak, going between that and then going between music, which is as you've been describing?
Oh, it's like mania inducing. It kind of feels like, you know, I don't know if you ever watched 30 Rock, but there's this one scene where Alec Baldwin is trying to record like a promo video for the NBC company he runs, and he's suddenly like, what do I do with my hands? I never thought about what I should do with my hands, because he's on camera. And that's what I think about when I go back to suddenly having to write my own music, because I don't have anyone telling me what to do. It's like, how do I write a synth bass line? I forgot, you know? And I start freaking out. And it gets super... The first time I finished a big thing and then went back to writing my own, you know, stuff, it was so confusing and disorienting, because suddenly I could do anything. And I've never, ever had issues with writer's block or just struggling to get something going. But it was the first time where I was just like, well, this is just a big blank page. Where do I start? So that can be weird. But for this last album, for me to get a project really going, I have to have a concept and a story and sort of something to build off of in that way, like a narrative. And that helped me with this, because at least then I could think of it like a film, and I actually made myself my own cue sheet for the album.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay.
I could at least like work in a way that I had been working for the last few years and was familiar with at this point.
Sure.
But it's weird. It's super weird, because then you also send it to your A&R at the label at Lucky Me, and I'm expecting, you know, like pages of notes like I've become accustomed to, and they're just like, yeah, the bass could be louder. And I'm like, okay. You know? But it can be weird. I actually have no memory of even like writing that album. I don't know how that happened, because I was working on an album while doing a Netflix series.
Right.
And I don't know how I found the time for that, but it seems to have come together more or less. The other thing that's weird about it too is with the film scoring stuff, I don't spend a lot of time doing mixdowns and mixing, because you have to send all of your files to whoever you're working for in stems, and they're ultimately going to do their own tinkering and with it anyways.
Yep.
And, you know, I've also realized, sure, there are times when your music gets front and center, but for the majority, if it's a dialogue-driven show, which is the majority of what I seem to be working on, it's going to be buried beneath a lot. You know, you've got the dialogue, sounds, whatever else. So me freaking out over the...
Yeah, that was another, if I can just interrupt you, that was another problem that I really had. Like when we got the, you know, the final cut, I was like, damn, this needs to be louder. You can't hear my fucking music.
You don't realize how quiet music is in a film or TV show till you've written it, let's say.
Yeah.
Like 100%. I remember the first time watching stuff, I was like, why is that drill when she's walking down the street so loud? It's blocking out the synth line, but it's like, you know, whatever. But so I don't fuss too much over, you know, I try to make everything sound as good as I possibly can. But if it's not like with dance music where I'll spend, you know, 3 hours tinkering a kick drum for stupid reasons. But
sure. I mean, that was actually another thing that I kind of spent a lot of time puzzling over, was to what extent to kind of get into the kind of sound design of the mix. So like, you know, all the panning and stuff and all, you know, the stuff that you normally do on a record. I spent ages not being quite sure about how deep to go into all that stuff. And as you say, if you're delivering in stems, it's likely going to get fucked around with anyway.
Yeah. I still do panning and I still mix it in the way that my instincts tell me. And if they disagree, they'll tell me. And once in a while, they will come back and be like, hey, can you tone it down with the hard left pan on the synth? Or could you make this more something, you know?
Yeah.
But that seems to happen pretty rarely. And I'm pretty, if you listen to my own music, it's pretty manic and it's pretty all over the place in terms of using the stereo field. And I still apply that to a lot of my scoring. I don't know if it's for the better or for the worse, but it's just the way my brain seems to go.
Totally.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Who are your major influences in this kind of work?
My all-time guy, if you want to say, it's Thomas Newman.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say our scores or the way we make music is similar, or not the way we make, but what we make is similar, but he has a real ambiance and sort of otherworldliness to the music he has always written. And I've always really identified with that.
Which examples?
Yeah. So I was gonna say, my favorite score of his, which gets a bit of a deeper cut, is Road to Perdition.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
I think it might be a Spielberg movie. I'm not sure, but anyway, it stars Tom Hanks and Paul Newman. Fantastic movie. But yeah, there's some incredible, and then the other, for all the laymen out there, the industry, when you write a music for a scene, you call it a cue. I don't know why. This is just how they say things. So
Right. When
the actors are in it, great scene. When you're just talking about the music, great cue. So there's some great cues in that film, one of which was actually turned into like a big drum and bass hit. I forget, by like SPY.
Okay.
It had this like vocal, like, how am I supposed to try?
It
has this great string section that is taken straight from the film. So that's a great example. I mean, he also did like Shawshank Redemption. Not my favorite of his, but also fantastic. And then the other favorite of his is American Beauty, because it was so forward thinking with all the metallic textures and percussion. Super cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. And then his father also, I think his name's David Newman,
mm-hmm.
but he did the score for one of my favorite movies as a child, The Mighty Ducks, which I have referenced in other interviews, but I don't know if the movies have held up, but goddamn, the music is still very good from those movies. But
nice.
Yeah, just epic. Anyway, Thomas Newman, I'm a huge, huge fan of Daniel Lopatin / Juan Otrix Point Never.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the synth god or whatever. And
his work is annoyingly good in those two movies in particular.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just, if you listen to my own work, I love manic, meandering sounding music. And I've tried to distill it down more for like what I do now. But yeah, I just love a guy who can, or anyone who can just like meander. Pull a bunch of cool, seemingly dissolute ideas together.
There's a few examples of that in Good Time, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah, like amazing. And just like, even just as an artist with album stuff, hugely influential for me. Yeah. And then another person, Rachel Portman. Again, doesn't sound like my music, but there's something to the way she voices her orchestral scores that I find really just satisfying and beautiful. I mean, Oscar winning, can't argue with that. Another one is her. Mika Levy, another one who can just sort of connect sort of seemingly unrelated sounds into a coherent piece of music. Their score for Under the Skin remains a huge sort of touchstone for me. Mm. So I'd say those are like my sort of main influences. But I also like to read more about, you know, Hans Zimmer, say what you will about the guy, he's a legend, but I don't find it as inspiring to, because I know that there's like a factory making that. You know what I mean?
I mean, certainly now there is now. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. The reason,
like, I read an interview, or not an interview, but I read an article in Vanity Fair a couple of years ago where it said the average Hans Zimmer score has about 200 people involved.
Right.
Which is unbelievable. And for him to be able to manage that is in itself inspiring. And, you know, he's still a role model. He's a role model, and I'm inspired by him and what he does in his music. It's incredible. But I like to read about people like Mika Levy and Daniel Lopatin, where I'm sure their setups, while they might have gear that I don't own, it's probably not too distant from what I'm working with right now.
Yep.
And whenever I'm sort of thinking, like, there's a couple of years ago where I was doing three films at once and I was freaking out, being like, how the hell does anyone do this? It was like a real challenge to myself. And all three directors were asking for very different sound palettes. Mm. And I was just like, God, how do these people do this? Because at the time, Mika Levy's score for Zola had just come out, and it was so different from Jackie, and it was different from this and that. And yeah, I just sort of found strength and inspiration in thinking about, like, well, you know, if they can figure it out, I can figure it out. And I did. I got fired from one of them, but the other two, I figured it out, and it came okay.
Okay.
And that's the other thing, too, is you have to, like, realize that none of it's personal, necessarily. Like, there's time restraints.
Right.
On this film, there were, like, budget issues suddenly, and... You know, directors all will sometimes have new ideas and be like, we're going in a new direction, and you just can't take it. You can't take it too personally. The same thing when you get approached to do a film or a TV show, or even once for me, a video game. I got approached to do a big video game for one of these massive video game companies a few years ago. And I went through like audition after audition and NDA after NDA. So I can't talk about what it was, but I think I'm allowed to mention that I did this. But, and then the end, they sent me, like, you know, a 5-page pamphlet about what kind of music they want. And then I did it all. And then the end, they're like, oh my gosh, we've sent you the wrong pamphlet. You've done the wrong type of music, but we're now out of time. We're so sorry. Maybe we can work together in the future. And you can't take it personally. It's just, there's so much going on.
Wow.
And this has happened to me with a few TV shows as well. Like, I did a whole 20-minute, when you get asked to, like, work on a show, they often ask you, can you score 2 or 3 scenes? And then you say, sure. And I did like 20 minutes of that for this show last year. And then, yeah, they sent me the wrong scenes and the wrong show. So I was like, but then this is what happens though. Then you have all this music you've written and you use it for the next thing that comes along. So I constantly am reusing ideas that for whatever reason didn't work with one scene or whatever. And directors are aware of this. Like with TV shows, I'll write a pretty killer piece of music for a scene and they'll be like, doesn't quite work for what I'm going for with this, but maybe 4 episodes down the line, there's a scene where this happens. Let's try it there and maybe it'll work.
Yeah.
So yeah, you kind of have to save every little scrap of music because it just, yeah, as I've sort of alluded to, the schedule catches up to you pretty fast.
Yeah. I'm just going back to Hans Zimmer. I had a question about him actually.
Yeah, go for it. Well, talk I guess about my buddy Hans. Not that I know him.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And his 200 helpers. One of the questions is actually more about kind of what your personal preferences are and the kind of scores that you like. I mean, a Hans Zimmer score, and I'm particularly, the most recent movie I saw with a Hans Zimmer score was Dune.
Yeah.
And to me, it almost ruined the entire movie.
Oh, really?
I couldn't fucking stand it. And it was so prominent. Like, and actually, because it got me thinking at the time, like, actually, I'm not sure if I like a score almost assuming a character in the movie, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have a general kind of preference in terms of style of scoring?
When you say style, do you mean like genre-wise or?
No, I mean in terms of the function that the score plays. I mean, obviously this is a question, it's a matter of preference for the director or whoever, you know, the kind of team who are making those kind of creative decisions. But like on a personal level, do you have a preference for that kind of thing on the role that a score plays in a kind of movie or a TV thing? Or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, personally, when I watch a movie, I like leaving thinking, remembering certain things. Like, you know, I enjoyed the Dune score actually. And
yeah,
like,
yeah, I mean, lots of people did, don't get me wrong. Like, you know.
And like, I found myself humming the main sort of Atreides theme for like 2 days after that. And same thing, like when I saw the Batman movie
right.
2 years ago or a year ago. I don't remember the movie all that much, to be honest, but I remember the score that like sort of do, 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 like that melody. I found myself humming it for days. and it's so simple. So I kind of like that. But on the other hand, I also like a very stripped back, minimal score. Like Under the Skin is pretty minimal. It's very, that's Mika Levy, and it's very restrained, but it's so effective. I haven't seen the new film with Mika Levy scoring it, The Zone of Interest, but the friends of mine who have seen it said there's 12 minutes of score in like the whole movie.
Right.
But you remember it, and it's in the right places. That's an interesting thing to talk about too, because sometimes, I mean, there's been times where I've just worked for days on some big scene, and then in the end we all agree, you know what, this didn't need music in the end.
Yeah, silence is better, right? Yeah.
And that can be effective too, or you just have little highlights here and there. So I guess it depends on the project. Like if I'm going to see some big space epic like Star Wars or Dune, I mean, you better be serving me big ass orchestral or whatever, you know?
Right. Or like your kind of period war drama or whatever.
Yeah. Like. Yeah. But like, if I'm going to see some creepy sci-fi, if you were able to make it eerie, that's cool too. Eerie and minimal.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, another good example, I guess, is like The White Lotus, which I guess is one of the most unique scores of the last few years. Have you watched that show?
No, I haven't.
It's on HBO. I recommend everyone see it. If not for anything, just the score is pretty unique. And it's a lot of weird timbered yodeling, I guess you could call it, with percussion. Yodeling is not the right word. I don't know what the right word for it is. But it's super, super interesting, and it can be super quiet, but then there are times when it's super in your face, and it really adds to the show, in my opinion. Like, with that show wouldn't make sense with different music for me. Whereas sometimes you see a movie and you're like, eh, that it could have been different. I don't know.
Right.
Like, could you imagine Star Wars with a different score at this point?
Well, yeah. I mean, actually, to be honest, I mean, as a kid, I was just obsessed with those themes. I really was. Like, I mean, almost more than the movies themselves, like the Star Wars theme and the Imperial March and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a major point of interest in music, you know, per se. Do you know what I mean? Just music itself for me as a kid. So
I mean, yeah. You also have to get used to, while you're scoring things, what's called underscore, which is just when you have a seemingly sort of banal undercurrent to highlight a scene. So like, let's say there's something creepy happening and you just have like drone or some sort of a slowly evolving subtle thing underneath something. There's no like big theme in that scene.
Yeah.
But now that I've been doing this for about 5 years full time, I'll watch something and be like, damn, that's some good underscoring. And it's like, right. No one else in the theater might be noticing, but I'm like, oh, how'd they do that? You know? And even with myself, I find that to be incredibly difficult sometimes because you have to make it so slow and subtle. And like, there's this hilarious line that comes to mind. Do you remember the movie Forgetting Sarah Marshall?
Okay, no, I haven't seen it, but I know what you mean. Yeah.
Another good one is Judd Apatow comedy from like 15 years ago. But in the film, Jason Segel plays a composer for some, you know, CSI like type show where it's like, we found the murderer because they left their semen at the crime scene, you know, things like that. And he's talking about his job, and he just describes it as making tones, lots and lots of ominous tones. And that often is what it is, actually. But you have to find a way to make those ominous tones develop and not keep the listener unengaged.
Yeah. That's what was difficult, actually, about writing for a comedy, is because it's like, what's the comedic equivalent of an ominous tone, right? You need these kind of like little accents which convey some sort of meaning, but you know, as it was tough, I have to say.
Oh my God, comedies! I did a big Netflix sci-fi show a few years ago for like children,
right?
For like 8 to 12, maybe 15-year-olds, and right. There were okay. A lot of comedic scenes. It's like, how do you make this not overly funny and stupid, but also underlying that this is supposed to be funny and stupid? It's yeah. So hard. It's unbelievably hard, because it's easy. If you tell me to write you like a sad piece of music, it's like, all right, well, here's an A minor chord on a piano, done, you know? But if it's like funny, it's like, you know, the first place your head goes is like doop, doo, 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 doo. But like, they don't want that. They want it to be like serious, you know? This is like a big multi-million-dollar production. Super hard. And it really makes you appreciate music in comedies.
Totally.
Honestly, yeah. Like ever since I started doing this, I'll watch, like I watched recently, really stupid movie, but I watched Wedding Crashers recently. And
okay, yeah.
Really stupid movie, but God, it's got a good score. Like there are some very sophisticated and complicated orchestral pieces in that movie. And I'm just thinking, there's so much music you don't even pay attention to in these things, but someone worked their ass off on this, you know?
Yeah.
One of my favorite scenes in Lord of the Rings is the scene where they're like lighting the beacons in the third movie. And this is incredible. I think it's the strongest piece of music in the whole trilogy. Like for a minute and a half, Howard Shore was just like going in to do this 1 minute seemingly like not important scene. And then when you look at it on YouTube, the top comment is like, Peter Jackson, colon. So Howard, we have this scene. We're lighting some candles and some beacons. It doesn't need to be too crazy, but it should be exciting. And it just says like, Howard Shore, hold my beer. And it's like, you know, crazy. And I love things like that. Cause you know too, like as a musician, you don't want to like half ass anything. And if I'm being told, all right, you know, we got to do 30 seconds. This guy's, I don't know, he's walking up the stairs to work, but you know, don't make it too crazy. But I'm like, I'm going to fucking make it crazy. And then you're going to tell me ways to reduce it. And that's the way I try to go about a lot of stuff now. I'm very bad at keeping things minimal musically. I'm getting better.
Right.
But it's better for me to send you the kitchen sink and then you tell me which taps to turn off, if that makes sense. And that's what's very freeing for me about this, because like with dance music, I will often overdo it perhaps. And I know a lot of DJs don't want too many, or when I was really making a lot of dance music, I know not too many DJs want to play like the most bombastic stuff, at least in the scene I operate in. Like, you know, if I play at Panorama Bar, I'm not going to throw at you some like crazy 200 layered Ableton, like 10 tricks point, never sounding thing. Whereas like your average house music track probably is a few channels really, you know? It's hard with dance music because I don't really have someone telling me like, all right, you've really overdone it again. Like turn it off, you know?
Okay. So just one more on scoring stuff. Actually just out of personal interest. Like, are there any significant differences between doing a movie and doing a, say like a 10 part series or whatever, like as you were describing?
Yeah, definitely. The biggest thing is time. When you do a movie, I've done three movies now. Well, four, if you count, five, if you count the indie ones, but let's say three like movies of note on a bigger budget for like notable distributors. Each of those, I was given about 4 months to do what's an hour and a half long film, more or less. Whereas with a TV show, you know, each episode's like anywhere between 45 and 65 minutes and you have 8 to 10 of them. So those you typically get about 5 to 6 months to work on.
In total?
Yeah, I'd say. But for instance, on the one I'm working on now, because the Hollywood strikes, we've kind of had to fast track it a little bit. So I think I've had about 4.5 months to work on this, which is pretty crazy. And I know this is the case for quite a few other people working at the moment. So that's definitely difference number one. And it's a very interesting thing. You become very intimate in getting to know the people you're working with over this period of time. You kind of, it's like going to the office every day. I'm waking up, I'm sending drafts, we're having Zooms, whatever. You get to know about them and their families and everything. And then the project ends and you go your separate ways. And that's that. Maybe you stay friends. I don't know. But it's interesting. It's super interesting. So that's definitely the biggest thing, is just time. And you have so much less time on a TV show because they're actively... They're on a very crazy schedule where it's like, we need episode one by February 25th. We need episode two by March 18th.
Right.
And you just have to like hit deadline after deadline after deadline. Whereas with a film, there are deadlines, but they're much more spread out and much more like less in concrete, if you know what I mean. It's like, here's the final date. We have to finish everything, but we could move it a day or two. Things like that.
Sure.
So that's number one. Number two, with the film, you have to sort of figure out ways to keep a same theme throughout the film, if that makes sense. Like with a TV show, there's so much more time to fill and there's so many more characters and ways the things that could develop. Whereas at least with my own experience, a film probably has a lot less characters and a lot less themes that need to be made, but you need to find ways to develop them very quickly throughout the film because you only have like 90 minutes to do that. And then just also, I have noticed like when I took those three films on at once that I mentioned earlier, I thought, oh, whatever. I've done like four episodes of TV at the same time. That'll be no problem. But then you realize each one you have to build what's called a sound world. Each one has its own world of sound and palette, if you will.
Yep.
And you have to stay within that palette. And if you try to introduce new sounds into it, you know, it doesn't always go so well. But sometimes it does go well. Like in reality, if you see that film, it's a lot of drones. It's a lot of weird textures and eerie sounds. It's a very eerie movie. But then in the last 10 minutes, it's kind of got this euphoric opening up. And I thought, I'll go for it. And I got a vocalist on that. And sent back this huge 14-minute ethereal piece of music, and the director was like, oh, I love it. Let's go with that. I was like, great. But it was such a curveball, and I stayed up all night writing it, and I was super nervous when I sent it off that, like, if they don't like this, what am I going to do? And with that film as well, for the opening, they initially wanted like a 2.5-minute piano piece, and I had never really done like a full on, you know, when I write, it's when I say 2-minute piano piece, you're like, eh, whatever. But when you actually have to write a 2-minute piano piece that evolves.
Yeah, yeah, right.
It's pretty tough stuff, actually. And
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so I wrote this like pretty comprehensive 2-minute piano piece, and we ended up not using it, and I don't know what to do with it at this point. But yeah, so that's the other difference. You just have to like take more swings with the film because you have less time to fill and less time to make the audience interested, whereas with a TV show, you have 8 episodes and seasons and stuff like this. But they're more or less, at the end of the day, this, at least work-wise, they're the same, more or less.
Yeah, yeah, really interesting, man. Okay, so I wanted to ask, if I meant to ask you at the start when we were talking about Berlin, what was your move to Europe initially motivated by?
I got my first big booking at Panorama Bar / Berghain when I was 23. And
shit, you were really young. Fuck.
Yeah, it was traumatizing for me. No, I'm kidding. But it was a little traumatizing. But no, sorry. Yeah, 23 turning 24, let's say.
Right.
Yeah,
you're from Toronto originally.
Yeah, so I was going to be a lawyer, essentially, and I was doing school. I just finished my undergrad with this kind of pre-law thing going on they had offered in Canada. And I finished my thesis and everything, and then I met with my professor, and I was like, look, I'm getting this attention for music stuff. He was like, go. Like, law is not going anywhere. And then I made a deal with my parents being like, let me get a job. Give me 1 year to see if this can work. I'll cook and clean the house, or I'll cook and I'll clean the house, and I'll have a part-time job. So I worked in childcare for many years.
Okay.
Taking care of little kids. So I did that. And by the end of the year, yeah, I had my first Berghain booking, and I just thought, all right, I'll go over there. I had a friend here with an apartment, so I stayed on his couch for about 2 months and yeah, navigated my way through the German bureaucracy and kind of never left.
Right.
Like, it was not, I had not intended to move here necessarily. I thought I'd come here and see what the lay of the land was, and somehow I ended up staying, which is like a classic thing, I think.
Right, sure.
But yeah.
Because you were releasing on Aus, weren't you?
Yeah, I was on Aus back then. And I started playing at Panorama Bar actually quite regularly back then. And then very quickly I realized I couldn't make a living from DJing. So that's why I started doing the personal training, and then between you and me, I was washing dishes under the table at a restaurant for many years.
Okay.
Hopefully nice. Nobody from immigration listens to this, but
right, okay.
That restaurant closed down, so I think everyone's fine. But yeah, so I just stayed here kind of doing your classic Berlin starving artist thing. I had this room for like 400 euros a month in vetting, and I think the real turning point for me, like, yeah, I started releasing albums and stuff, but then this personal training stuff, meeting all these, I was training managers, DJs, PR people, like, it didn't really lead me to any opportunities necessarily, but I got a lay of the land and understanding how the industry worked, at least back then. I think now if you ask me to explain dance music to you, I'd just say TikTok. But back then, you know, it was very much RA was a big deal and press was a big deal, and your agent could make or break your career, which maybe they still can, but I don't really know in the same way. But yeah, so it was really interesting. And I was meeting all these people who were like 5 to 10 to 15 years older than me. And I just sort of, that's how I made all my friends here as well. Cause I don't really drink. I don't really do drugs. And yeah, it was suddenly all these DJs were coming to me to like make them healthy. And that's how I made most of my friends.
Yeah, sure. It's funny because, Recondite was my personal trainer.
Yeah, so a lot of people have told me this. Have I met Recondite? Because you both were personal trainers. Yeah. And I've never met him.
But, okay. No, it's like basically an identical story. Like it was like Holmes Place Gym in Friedrichshain. Like this is like 2000.
Fancy boy.
2007 or something. 2000. Yeah, it would have been 2007, 2008, some of the time. So a few years before, I guess.
I was at McFit, but yeah. Right, I know Holmes Place.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you're going to work in a gym in Berlin, you're probably going to meet DJs, right?
and people
from the industry. Right?
I've recently switched to Holmes Place from McFit just because McFit had a huge brand pivot, and now they have live DJs in there, and it's incredibly loud.
Shit, okay.
and with my ear as it is, and just I just can't deal with the music. They all wear t-shirts that say "Pump Up the Gym," and
that's not sound good.
It's a bit much. Anyway, yeah. So now I'm at Holmes' place, and suddenly it's like, oh, here's where the fancy DJs are, and I'm surrounded by fancy DJs, and it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
But now I'm not really involved as much, so I'm not going to go up to them being like, "What's up?" But if I see, like, you know, Hildur Gottater, if I don't know how to pronounce her last name, but if I see her at Holmes' place, I might say, like, hey, we work right in the same industry now. But yeah, anyway, long story. That's how I ended up in Berlin. And almost coming on 10 years here. And as I said, it's changed and it hasn't. It's just as chaotic as it always was, but for double the price.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm working backwards here, but what was, how did you get into music in the first place? And specifically dance music, like, what was your route in to all of this stuff?
Well, music in general, my mom, now retired, was a high school music teacher for her career. So very musical. She had me playing instruments from a very young age, which I'm thankful for. And my father plays piano quite well. And he's a huge, probably of anyone I've ever met, aside from my friend Jesse, he's a huge jazz aficionado, really knows his stuff. Mm. Which, ironically, I hated my whole childhood.
Okay.
Nothing like doing a road trip with your dad, listening to, like, free jazz for 3 hours. But, yeah, so that got me into music. And in the UK, you call a public school a private school. And I think it's switched. But anyway, government-run schools in Toronto have very good, or used to at least, have very good music programs. So from grade 5, I was in, like, my school's orchestra. And my mom was very smart, and she strategically told me to start playing the viola because it would open up opportunities to go to other government schools that were out of our district, because everyone always wants viola players. And that's exactly what happened. I was able to go to the better high school just slightly out of my district because they needed viola players.
Wow.
Okay. So she had me doing that at an early age. And yeah, so I was into music, you know, did the classic, got into hip hop, got into rock and roll, whatever. And then in high school, a friend of mine, Andrew, was starting to DJ, but he was DJing, I don't know what you call this stuff, like Bloody Beetroots and Mastercraft and like early Steve Aoki. Sort of thing, like very abrasive, glitchy. I don't know.
Bloghouse.
Yeah, Bloghouse, sure. I hated it. I fucking hated that stuff.
Yeah, sure, me too.
But
me too.
He gave me a Dillinger mixtape or something. And he also gave me a dubstep thing. He gave me Casper Rusko Fabric Mix.
Yep.
And that blew it wide open for me. I couldn't believe my ears when I heard that for the first time. And then actually, from your label, I got really into early Hot Flush stuff. This is like 2007-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then he took me to see Benga, who I'd never heard of before, at a club in Toronto. And then from that, I was hooked. I was completely obsessed. And my whole life just sort of pivoted into dance music, I suppose, mainly dubstep. And I was staying up in the middle of the night listening to Rinse FM on my very old Mac.
Really? Wow.
I was hooked. Yeah. I mean, I still, even in my living room right now. And then eventually, yeah. So, and then I went to...
Hang on a sec. Do you remember which shows on Rinse you're into?
Oh God, no. I mean, I didn't know who anyone was. I did listen to N-Type. I listened to N-Type show a lot.
Yep.
And then I was also obsessed with, like, in New Music We Trust on BBC Extra. Like, mm-hmm. I was just like, I would follow Scream and Benga and like a few other names I was into and see when they were on the radio. And that was pretty much it. I didn't like regularly listening to Rinse, like any specific shows. Cause again, I was in Canada. So,
right. You just stick it
on. This all changed when I did an exchange for England. I did an exchange for university to England. I went to Leeds for a year.
Did you?
And,
okay.
Yeah. And once I was there, I just...
So what year would that have been?
Third year of university. So 2011 to 2012.
Right.
Post-dubstep. Yeah. Well, that was huge into that. And I'm actually looking in my living room. I'm looking at it right now. I went to a DMZ night and I stole a poster while I was there.
Right. Well, at the West Indian Center.
No, so I went after that. They had changed it to Vox Warehouse. So I'm looking at it. It's got like, you know, a who's who, Digital Mystics, Lofa, Chromestar, Youngsta, Chef, D-Bridge, Synchro, like, you know, everyone on here.
Yeah.
So I was, obsessed. That music consumed me. And then the James Blake stuff came along and that consumed me. And then eventually, one of your tunes, one of your tracks and a track you released were what eventually led me to like trance and my obsession with trance. Okay. It was your track Adrenaline.
Right. Yes.
And then you released a track by a guy, Locked Groove, I think called Dream Within a Dream.
Yeah.
And I became very enamored with the melodies in that. And it just so happened at the same time, the YouTube algorithm gave me James Holden Balance 005, which I still think is the best mix of all time.
Yeah, great.
And then very quickly my dubstep shifted to. To be fair, by that point I'd been like 7 or 8 years into dubstep, maybe 5 or 6, 7 years, and I was starting to kind of get bored with the sound and the scene. And as you've alluded to many times on the show, the Skrillex stuff was coming up, and it was getting a bit too intense for me.
Right.
Not that trance isn't intense, but I needed some more melodies.
It's a different kind of intense.
Yeah, after many years of like very sparse bass-driven music, I needed some melody. And then the next thing you know, I'm finding all this stuff. And it totally changed my life. And I started to shift all of my music, and for the first time really finding a lot of success, or not a lot, but finding success with what I was making, I guess, because I like having a melodic sensibility, and you can't really do that outside of trance. No, you can, but trance encourages it.
Sure. Yeah. So, okay. What year did you move to Berlin?
2015.
Right. Okay.
So it was a few years of getting my shit together, living at home, I had to finish university, a thesis, all that. And then, during that time, writing a ton of music.
Sure. Yeah. So you made a joke about this, but when you walked into Panorama, walked into Berghain for the first time, was it a bit of a culture shock, a bit of an intimidating experience?
Oh, well, even before I walked into it, the first time I played there was for CSD, which is, I guess, the big event of the year. Yep. It's like gay pride, I suppose. And So I, like 23, turning 24, I was wearing like, I don't know, it's like, it's not a dress, it's like a big shirt that pregnant women wear. I don't know what those are called, like a muumuu. Anyway, I had this big one I saw at a secondhand store with cool patterns on it, so I wore it. So it was kind of like a dress. And I'm walking up to it with my friend Teddy, and I'm supposed to play at 4 p.m. on a Sunday, and there's nobody in line or anything. And then as we're getting there, the bouncer's screaming at us in German. And at that point, my German was sehr schlecht, as they say. So I started approaching, the guy was yelling, and I kept walking, and he started yelling in English, fuck off, you're not getting in. And I'm sure they were just having like a long day of bouncing. Right. Anyway, so I get to the front, he's like, do you not hear me? I'm like, and then my friend Teddy Fink was like, oh, he's playing here. And the guy was like, oh, so. And he's like, oh, are you okay? Good for you. And anyway, at the time...
Like, that is an absolute classic fucking Berghain. Yeah. That's so the story, then, it really is.
Like, ND Baumecker, Andreas, was the booker at the time. So he comes down and he's laughing. He's like, oh, stop scaring him. Come on. And, you know, at this point, I'm like shaking as much as I could be. I mean, I hadn't even slept the night before. I was so nervous for this, you know? And so I go up there. I'm like shaky. I brought a bunch of vinyl to play because I wanted, getting ready for this gig in this year of like staying at my parents. It was like living at my parents' house for that year was kind of like the closest dance music montage you could get, like Rocky. Like morning I had these crazy routines. My dad also was like, you know, if you're going to live with us and have this part-time job, I want you to like not mess around. So he made me like wear a shirt and tie in the morning.
Oh my God, are you serious?
To like make music. This only lasted for the first few weeks. Eventually, it was more chill. But like, so
that is straight out of American Beauty, right?
Yeah. So I would wake up and, you know, make my mom breakfast some days, and then I would immediately do 45 minutes practicing vinyl on my turntables, and then I would, for the rest of the day, if I didn't have work that day, work was usually around 4 p.m. So I would work for the rest of the day just making music, and like really trying to treat it like a 9-to-5 job. So anyway, when I got to Panorama Bar, I was like, yeah, I know how to play vinyl. I'm super confident. And then once I got up there in the booth, my hands were shaking, and no matter what I tried to do, I just couldn't put the needle on the right thing. It was terrifying. And then this woman kept telling me to smile, and I probably wasn't because I was so nervous. And then she eventually leapt over the turntables and grabbed my face to make me smile. At which point some undercover bouncer just came out of nowhere and pulled her, you know, got her out of there. But, Anyway, I guess Berghain liked what I did because I got booked there 2 months later.
Nice.
And then that continued what I guess I could call my home club relationship for many years. I'd play there, you know, two or three times consistently for about 6 years until the pandemic. And then the other thing that happened playing there was I was playing a lot of trance, which in the moment worked really, really well. I remember the first time I played there, I played Sasha Expander, which now doesn't...
I think I was in the audience for that.
Okay.
So I think I was. Yeah. I certainly have heard you playing that record before in Panorama.
So at the time, nowadays you wouldn't blink at this because, you know, I guess the times have changed. But at the time, I remember, I'm now friends with her, but Natalie, who's a lovely woman who does the lighting at Panorama Bar, she ran over like, what is this? No one plays this here. This is crazy. And I was like, oh, it's Sasha. Who? Crazy. And
yeah, I could definitely co-sign that. Eyebrows were raised.
Well, it went off. Like, people were enjoying it. But then the next day, I got torn to shreds on the RA event for this. And I remember the top comment had like 60 likes or whatever, upvotes. And it was just like, I flew all the way to Australia for CSD and I had to listen to Expander. And I remember just thinking like, oh, God, I need to rethink my whole approach. Which I didn't change. But first gig was pretty nuts. And
I had never been to
Panorama Bar before. Like, this was like literally my first time going there as well. So, Oh, that's not true.
Yeah, I mean, that was my original question was related to that more than actually playing. Like, just in terms of like the actual place, like the, you know, what it's like in there.
Yeah. I haven't been there really since... I've been there a couple times since the pandemic opened, but so I don't know what the vibe in there is so much, but I've heard it hasn't really changed, to be honest. But yeah, it was like the first time I played there, CSD, I remember walking into Panorama Bar and someone was getting a blowjob. I was like, okay. And, it becomes normalized within minutes. The second time I played there, I brought a friend over from Toronto who was a bit older than me, and... there was a woman there wearing a straitjacket with her breasts like cut out of the straitjacket, and she was wearing a gas mask. So she had these very like erratic kind of deranged movements because her hands were straitjacketed to her sides. Like she was wearing a straitjacket and Jesus. She had this gas mask, and it was like out of like a zombie movie, honestly. And I remember my friend was totally taken aback by this, but by the end of the night, he was like, it's as if he'd been there for, you know, going there for years. You get used to it quite quickly. I will say, the first time I played there, I did have this one guy following me around for the rest of the day, trying to suck my thumb and oftentimes just doing it without asking. And that was new for me. I never experienced that before. But that wasn't like a thing that would happen every time I'd go to Panorama Bar or anything, but it was like this sort of hedonistic openness I never really experienced in a club. Like you read all these interviews and things about like, oh, the club is open and amazing and Toronto's fine, but I never really had that experience there, especially in dubstep. My experience with clubbing, so to that point, I'd been to a few nights in Toronto that weren't dubstep for the most part. Especially in England, my clubbing was all centered around dubstep and drum and bass, and you know, you're not seeing that stuff there. It's more just like people vibing. I don't know what the right word is, but
yeah.
So then I got there, and I ended up eventually also playing like Snacks in the Laboratory a couple times. Mm-hmm. So
for the benefit of our audiences, we haven't had a description of this before on the show. So here we go.
So Snacks. So Laboratory is underneath Berghain. It's like the, I guess, men's club underneath Berghain, where they do different themed nights every night of the week from like 8 to 10 p.m. and occasionally big weekend parties. And they have two events a year called Snacks, and then they have another one called Revolting, which I played once, where they let women in and it's just open to everybody. But essentially it's like all the themed nights combined into one for Snacks. So, and by themed, I mean like the, you know, various sexual proclivities that people might be interested in isolated on different nights, let's say. That's a more eloquent way of saying it. So I'll let you go just Google Laboratory. They have little illustrations showing what each theme of the night is. And anyway, so at Snacks, yeah, they combine all of that into one big fun extravaganza. And what's interesting about Laboratory is the DJ booth, typically a DJ booth shows you from the waist up. In Laboratory, you're on a raised platform and they only show you from the waist down. And that right there, I think, sort of sets the vibe. But I fucking loved playing there. That was one of the best gigs of my life. Yeah, it was pretty nuts. And I was also like very honored to be allowed to play like this famous event that seemed to have a heritage to it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And yeah, I saw things that day or night that I'd never seen before, and it was interesting.
I believe Snacks was actually the party which preceded Oscar.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what I mean by like heritage sort of important party.
Yeah.
I guess. And then the other one I played is, I think, on ND Baumecker's Night, Revolting. And that's the one where they let everybody in to do whatever. And I saw even more at that party, to be quite honest. Yeah, that was, I had just gone off a plane after spending like 3 weeks at my parents' house, like being very wholesome, and then went straight to that. And I was so jet lagged. And I was just like, oh my God, this is what I do for a living. And it's always been funny during those years. I'd say 2017, 2018, 2019, and then the first few months of 2020 were like my peak DJ, like two gigs a weekend sort of situation. Mm. And I just, yeah, it became such a funny thing to describe to my cousins and my family, like what I do or was doing necessarily. And I was a lot of like, you know, I'd say like, oh, I went and played in Japan this past week, and I get a pat on the shoulder. Good for you. Good for you. And no one could understand that, like, I could make a living doing this. Cause I think my parents are probably like, Nathan's washing dishes illegally. But, yeah. Anyway, now that I'm doing this stuff, my liberal Jewish extended family can read about me in, you know, a paper of repute, let's say.
And oh, right. Okay. So it makes more sense.
Yeah. I think everyone's relieved and happy. Like, my grandfather died last year at the age of 102, and he was very lucid until the end. He's quite a famous rabbi. And in our last real big hangout, he was just like, you know, I'm quite relieved you're done with this whole DJ thing. But, you know, I'm proud of you that you did it. And I'm like, oh, thanks. No. You know, I doubt he had a clue what being a DJ meant or anything, and I wouldn't expect him to at that age. But yeah, he got enough gist. He got the gist to know that it was, you know, probably not a healthy lifestyle, let's say.
Yeah.
And I'm quite relieved to be out of it. I'm not out of it. Like, I'm still actively doing it, but just at the moment with my ear, I've had to sort of take a back seat to it. And just also with my schedule. And I'm hoping to DJ. I'm going to DJ a few times already this year. There's a few bookings coming up. And I am working on dance music for the first time in a while. So that will start happening again. But I will say it's nice to just sort of have like a creative, not 9-to-5 job, but like it does sometimes seem like that. And one of the most freeing aspects of doing this score work, I think, is that some of the people that I admire the most, like contemporary active scoring people that you've probably never heard of, like your average person probably doesn't know who are scoring super, super cool TV shows and films, but you go on their Instagram and it's like them barbecuing on the weekend with their kid. They have 400 followers, you know, like, and that they're not in like the seemingly endless Instagram rat race that DJing kind of started to become around after I moved here. And, it's been super, I mean, I'm still, you know, you give up one mental health issue of getting locked into this Instagram. Am I good enough because I don't have as many followers as this person? What else can I do? Do I need to make a good selfie? And now that's been replaced like, oh my God, I owe 10 minutes of music in an hour. Like, this week for me is that. Like, I have a lot of music to write this week. And after we get off this call, I'm going to frantically start writing it. But I don't find myself... I deleted Instagram off my phone in October. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I was a DJ, I probably wouldn't have had the freedom to do that necessarily.
Right. Yeah.
I still do posts once in a while when I have a project or I have to talk about it. But yeah, I think that's been just so freeing for me. But at the same time, as I said, I still listen to everyone's mixes. I still check out everything. And I still have my morning routine is checking all my Digger YouTube channels, you know, of like all these people uploading, God bless them, uploading all this music I otherwise probably never would have heard of.
Right. Yeah.
And at this point, I don't DJ as much as I used to. I might start again. Who knows? But yeah, it's like I'm still in the habit of a DJ.
Sure.
And I've also noticed a lot of my DJ friends. It's been interesting to see. Like, you know, one of my good friends, Avalon Emerson, she's obviously still one of the best in the world, but she put an incredible album of like dream pop last year.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then another good friend of mine, Jazz, put out this incredible album where she was singing in Spanish last year. So it's been interesting. I think as a lot of us get older, just... you know, you're creatively itchy to try other things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I have found that DJ world, I'm sure you can appreciate this as well, is it can be kind of like, this is how it's done.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, there's a set of rules. I mean, like there is to most things, to be fair.
But yeah, like, I mean, it goes back to like what I said earlier with the trance and panorama bar. Like, I didn't realize that was taboo at the time. It was just like, well, you booked me. Here's what I like. And then I had, you know, the powers that be on the RA message board, who I became quite familiar which names to look out for at this point after a while, telling me what's up. And I, you know, I have a few friends who are in this real like minimal club division air world
yep.
that I'm not really, I don't really have much to do with, but I've talked to them. And apparently before maybe a few years ago, you could not play like UK garage or trance and that stuff. And now it's all the rage.
Right.
So I think yeah. the lines are blurring and I find that exciting. And it does make me want to jump back in a big way. But yeah, it's been a funny thing to sort of try to divide these two worlds and connect them at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. So, okay, last question or last thing to discuss.
Sorry, that was a long rant.
No, not at all.
Long rant with a lot of unnecessarily long words, but sorry about that.
Honestly, the podcast format lends itself to extended answers, so that's absolutely fine. I think me and you are maybe the only Taylor Swift fans in the dance scene.
Oh, I know a few closeted fans, but
yeah, but no one is out. No one is willing to articulate their admiration for Taylor Swift.
Well, I got myself into some hot water with Taylor Swift years ago.
Go on.
I did one of those Fact Against the Clocks videos, and in it, I just chopped up a Taylor Swift sample, which, you know, whatever. It's what's the difference if I'm chopping up Taylor Swift or Ciara? I like Taylor Swift, but then. Yeah, dance music didn't really like Taylor Swift back then. And got a lot of angry messages about that. I think I probably got more angry messages about that than anything in my life, to be honest.
Really? Wow.
It like dominated my DMs for like months. Yeah, it was hardcore actually. But now it's, as I said, everything's blurred. I think everyone likes everything now.
Yeah, maybe.
What era of Taylor Swift are you into? Are you into the whole thing?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. But I mean, my favorite album is certainly 1989. But I mean, I do like the recent stuff as well. I actually really like the two albums that came out in the pandemic too, actually. How about you?
Yeah, I like Folklore was great during the pandemic. I mean, help me through that second German lockdown for sure. That was brutal. I mean, I've been a big fan of hers since high school. Like I'm coming from her first album with like Our Song and Tim McGraw, because as I said earlier, like I play, or did I mention earlier? Like I love country music.
Sure.
And I, before dance music, before all of this, I was playing banjo and I used to record like really, really bad bluegrass and country onto GarageBand with no mic, just with like my computer mic. And I'd play fiddle, banjo, guitar, and mandolin, all of which I still have. And yeah, I was obsessed. She was great. And I was really like following country as you would follow dance music back then. It was like Brad Paisley, Taylor Swift. Can't remember who else was big at the time. But yeah, so I was into that era. And I still know all the words to that first album, which benefits me hugely during times of karaoke. But besides that, it hasn't really brought much to my life. Yeah, I'd be honest. But yeah. Huge into that. Yeah, Folklore was great. I actually kind of liked the last album. Midnight's had a couple of hot tracks on there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Antihero is a great tune. Amazing.
I mean, I've been saying it to people for a while. No one's believing me, but I think she's going to be president in 2032 if there still is a presidency to have by then. But
yeah.
I'm calling it now. I think it's going to be her versus The Rock, Dwayne Johnson.
I mean, yeah. I think The Rock basically is like studiously apolitical though. Cause I mean, I actually absolutely see the potential as well, but I mean, he just seems to be like,
he's a man of Christian values. So I could
see that. Right. Oh, okay. So he's going to be
an AOC Taylor Swift ticket.
Right. With The Rock as the Republican candidate.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Haven't really figured out who he'll pick as his running mate, but, I mean, maybe he gets one of the Trump sons jacked as hell and then they do it together. I don't know. Call me up. I'll train you.
Shit. Yeah. Okay. So let me ask you as a last question.
Sure.
Was it in any way signposted in that really early era of Taylor Swift that she might eventually acquire the kind of cultural status that she has in the last couple of years?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I was into Taylor Swift in grade 12, so I'm trying to think what year that is. That must be 2007.
Yeah, that's like the
2006, 2007. And yeah, at this point, I just sort of knew her as an up and coming country thing. And I really knew about her because I had a friend from Florida, who, you know, belly of the beast, southern United States, who really knew her country. And she would send me CDs because that's what you did back then. Yeah. And she used to send me CDs, and one of them had a lot of Taylor Swift. I was like, oh, who's this? And I looked her up on, you know, early Google, and it was like, you know, someone my age and just kind of looked like a country music person with an acoustic guitar. I think it all, I mean, this is well documented, but I'm sure you could make this argument, and I'm sure it has been made, that once Kanye kind of did his whole VMA thing with her, it was inevitable that she would just become a cultural figure. And yeah, she's played the game quite well, I guess you could say.
No, it's crazy because like it seems to just have another step to go regardless of wherever she is. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I really didn't see this kind of most recent iteration, which is just...
Yeah, I don't know how this has happened. Yeah. Like when I worked in daycare, I worked with a couple women who were 4, 5, 6 years older than me, and they were all going to concerts of hers back then that I couldn't quite afford yet. And, you know, it made sense to me that she would fill like, you know, the arena in Toronto, but now it's like I think I slept on a lot of this stuff during the pandemic. It's the same with dance music, like as I said earlier, a lot of people are on lineups now. I don't have a clue. And like this whole Eurodance thing that's going on right now, I didn't realize that started during the pandemic, and I guess I never really caught on to when Taylor became like bigger than Beyonce. Seemingly.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Crazy. I just don't know when that happened. And now Beyonce, I notice, is doing country music, so it's all going full circle in a way.
Do you have a favorite Taylor Swift song as a very last question?
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic and my karaoke choice every time, Our Song from the first album. Mainly, it was the first banjo line I ever learned when I bought my banjo.
Okay.
I used to sit in my room playing along to that, and then Neil Young, Old Man.
Right. Cool.
Yeah, how about you?
I think, I don't know. I couldn't pick one. 1989... as an album, I listened to on a couple of road trips, one of which involved taking the ferry from Barcelona to Mallorca, which is where I live now, an overnight ferry. And I just remember listening to that album, like at kind of 5 a.m. on the deck of this ferry. And it's absolutely ridiculous. I realized listening to Taylor Swift album in that kind of
there's no
setting,
wrong place to listen to Taylor Swift.
No, exactly. Exactly right. Exactly right. Well, listen, man, this has been great. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, sorry if I rambled, but hopefully
nothing too bad.
Well, thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, that was Nathan Mackay. What an interesting conversation. What a great story. And some great stories in there too. I've never played one of those Berghain parties that he was talking about. I got invited to play Snacks once, but it never happened for some reason. So yeah, sounds like it could be quite fun. And yeah, just lots of great info about the film and TV stuff too. I know lots of you are into that. And, you know, as I mentioned in the conversation, I've done a bit of it, but it would be quite fun to do some more. Although, having said that, it is kind of hard work. Harder work than you might think, I have to say. And it is very different working to someone else's direction when you're used to just doing your own thing. But yeah, it is fun though, nonetheless. And it's always fun seeing the results. That's the most fun bit, is seeing how it comes together, assuming you're happy with what you've done and happy with what the director did with your music. Anyway, okay, we're done here. This has been a good episode. Reminder that you can support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/scubaofficial. There's also a Spotify playlist you can follow that contains all the episodes and lots of the music that we talk about. And also, there is the Discord, our Discord server. hotflushrecordings.com/discord gets you through to that server, and we'd love to have you there. Also, scubaofficial.io/supports. I should mention that too. If you're feeling flush today, then that is the link to go to, scubaofficial.io/support. All right, we're done here. I've been Scuba. This has been a good episode. I said that already. I will see you back here same time, same place next week for the next episode of a Not a Diving podcast. Thank you. Not a Diving Podcast.
with Scuba.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.